Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome back to another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we get into the episode proper, just a few things I wanted to touch upon. This is going to be a quick weekly horror news, but it has been announced that HBO Max is going to be coming out with the new show, Welcome to Derry. This is going to take place in the 60s, and is going to center around all the weird shit that goes on in the town of Derry, who everybody who's a Stephen King fan knows is a town where a lot of his stories are placed, and it's a particularly evil town with a lot of supernatural things going on. But that's not what pisses me off. What pisses me off about this show that they're working on is that it's going to center around the origins of Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Now, this wouldn't be a problem if they would stop fucking around with movies that have already been done and just come up with something entirely new. I mean, I guess the origins of Pennywise is something new that hasn't been done yet. But I'm kind of concerned because I'm worried that they're going to fuck the whole storyline of it up. Because this show is supposed to take place during the 60s. Which is when the original 1990s It miniseries took place. At least in the beginning. You know, the remakes of It Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 took place in the 80s. At least when they were kids. But anyway. And okay, so if it's going to center around the origins of Pennywise, if you've read the original book, Pennywise had supposedly been in Derry for centuries. But if this show is only going to take place, or the series is only going to take place in the 60s, how is it going to be about the origins of Pennywise if it's taking place in the 60s when he's supposedly been there forever? It just doesn't really make any sense to me. I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and find out when that show actually comes out. Release date hasn't been set yet. They haven't even begun filming it, I don't believe. But anyway, a little more news. On April 27th, make sure you tune in because that will be the 1 year anniversary of this podcast. And I've got Animus Morgue returning. And I've got a very special guest coming on for that episode. Entropy in Motion, frontman and guitarist and friend of mine, A.K. Herrera, is going to be appearing as well. And it's going to be a good show, I think. So make sure you tune in on the 27th to listen to that. Speaking of which, Entropy in Motion has a new 3-song single out, one original song and 2 remixes of older songs. You should definitely check it out. It's a little bit different than what he usually does, but the first song is actually dedicated to me. Because he's one of my go-tos when I'm doubting myself about my music or my podcast or whatever. And he's been a great help to me. So you should definitely check that single out. It's called Dire Wolf on My Trail. And speaking of music, I also have a new album out. 15 tracks, 46 minutes. It's self-titled, Just Raped by Wolves. And if you haven't checked that out yet, you definitely should. I'd appreciate it. You can find my new album and Entropy in Motion's new single on Spotify and all the other major music streaming services. And although he's mentioned it several times when he's co-hosted this show, I wanted to bring it up myself. You should also check out Animus Morgue's YouTube channel, where he plays, streams, and babbles on, much like he does whenever he co-hosts, video games. It's really entertaining, and you should definitely give it a watch. You can find it on YouTube underneath the Animus Morgue title. So definitely check that out as well. He's also someone that's a go-to when I'm having my doubts about everything. And he has also been a great help throughout many years through many personal issues. He's a good guy, so you should definitely check his shit out. All right, now that all that's out of the way, let's get into the episode proper. This episode, I thought I'd talk about some supposedly quote-unquote cursed films. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give a very brief breakdown of the movies. Since if you listen to this podcast, I assume you've seen or at least heard of or have a very brief understanding about what the movie's about. And then I'm going to get into why these movies are supposedly have a quote-unquote curse on them. So let's get into it, because we've got a lot of shit to cover. With all that said, the first film is 1982's Poltergeist.
The house looks just like the one next to it. And the one next to that. And the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so unlucky.
With their three children. And something more.
Something's funny going on here next door. Something,
We were wondering if maybe you had experienced any disturbances.
What kind of disturbances?
I don't know whatever's over this house.
It knows what scares you.
So a basic rundown of Poltergeist is a Freeling family moves into a new home in a planned community. The father, Stephen, is a successful real estate developer, and Diane looks after their three children, 16-year-old Dana, 8-year-old Robbie, and 5-year-old Carol Ann. Late one night after moving in, Carol Ann is discovered conversing with the family's television set while it displays nothing but static. And the next night, she again fixates on the TV, and a ghostly white hand emerges from the screen. More bizarre events occur the following day. A glass of milk spontaneously breaks, silverware bends, and furniture moves all on its own. These events initially seem benign, but they slowly start to grow more sinister, such as when a severe thunderstorm breaks, a gnarled backyard tree seemingly comes alive, and a large limb crashes through the children's bedroom window and grabs Robbie. And while the rest of the family rushes out to save him, Carol Ann is sucked into a portal inside the closet. A trio of a parapsychologist and two team members are called in to investigate, and they determine that there is a poltergeist intrusion involving multiple ghosts, and they all want Carol Ann. It is eventually discovered that this this community was being built on an old graveyard, but it turns out that they moved the graves but kept the bodies buried there, and the spirits are pretty pissed off, and that's why this is all going on. And it ends with the Freeling family all being able to escape, but the house then basically implodes into the portal. And the movie ends. Okay, so why this movie is supposedly cursed has been widely explained and dove into. In case you don't know, I'm gonna get into it. It mainly is considered cursed because of deaths of two of the stars of this trilogy of movies. The first was Dominique Dunn. Dominique Dunn was daughter. I just lost myself in my notes. Hold on. Was the daughter of Dominique Dunn, an author, and sister of Griffin Dunn, who was an actor who is most commonly remembered for his role in An American Werewolf in London. Dominique starred in a made-for-TV movie, Diary of a Teenage Hitchhiker, in 1979, and she would go on to appear in several 1980s popular television shows, such as Lou Grant, Family, Heart to Heart, and Fame. She also had a reoccurring role on the comedy-drama TV series Breaking Away. And she, of course, starred in this film, Poltergeist. And everything was fine until Dunn met John Thomas Sweeney, a sous chef at a restaurant, Ma Mason, at a party in 1981. After a few weeks of dating, they moved into a one-bedroom house together on Rangeley Avenue in West Hollywood. Sweeney was particularly jealous, and due to this jealousy and possessiveness, however, the relationship quickly deteriorated. The couple was reported to fight frequently, and Sweeney began physically abusing Dunn. According to one account, during an argument on August 27, 1982, he yanked handfuls of her hair out by the roots. Frightened, Dunn fled to her mother's house, where Sweeney showed up and began to bang on the door and windows, demanding to be let in. Dunn's mother told him to leave and threatened to call the police. But a few days later, Dunn returned to the home she shared with Sweeney, and the two resumed their relationship. In another incident, at their home on September 26, 1982, Sweeney grabbed Dunn by the throat, threw her on the floor, and began to strangle her. A friend who was staying with the couple at the time heard loud gagging sounds and ran into the room where Dunn was being physically attacked. Dunn told the friend that Sweeney had tried to kill her, but Sweeney denied the claim and requested Dunn to come back to bed. She pretended she was going to comply but snuck out of the bathroom window instead. When Sweeney heard Dunn start the engine of her car, he ran out and jumped on the hood of the car. Dunn stopped the car long enough for Sweeney to jump off the hood and then drove away. For the next few days, she stayed with her mother and at the homes of her friends. She later called Sweeney, however, and then ended the relationship. After he moved out, she had the locks changed and moved back into the Rangeley Avenue home. Then, on October 30th, 1982, a few weeks after Sweeney and Dunn broke up, Dunn was at her West Hollywood home rehearsing for the miniseries V with actor David Packer. While she was speaking to a female friend on the phone, Sweeney had the operator break into the conversation. Dunn reportedly told her friend, "Oh God, it's Sweeney, let me get him off the phone," and 10 minutes late, but... However, 10 minutes later, Sweeney showed up at Dunn's home. After speaking to him through the locked door, Dunn agreed to speak to him on the porch while Packer remained inside. Outside, the two began to argue, and Packer later reported that he heard smacking sounds, two screams, and a thud. Concerned, he called the police, but he was informed that Dunn's home was out of their jurisdiction. Packer then phoned a friend and told him if he was found dead, John Sweeney was the killer. Packer then left the home through the back entrance, approached the driveway, and saw Sweeney in some nearby bushes, kneeling over Dunn. Sweeney told Packer to call the police, and when the police arrived, Sweeney met them in the driveway with his hands in the air and stated, "I killed my girlfriend and I tried to kill myself." Sweeney later testified that he and Dunn had argued, but he couldn't remember what happened after their exchange. He claimed he could only recall being on top of her with his hands around her neck. Dunn was then transported to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, where she was placed on life support. She never regained consciousness, however, and over the following days, doctors performed brain scans, which revealed that due to oxygen deprivation, she had no brain activity. On November 4th, her parents consented to have her removed from life support, and she died with her kidneys and heart being donated to transplant recipients. Sweeney was then charged with attempted murder. However, those charges were dropped after Dunn's death, and subsequently, Sweeney was charged with first-degree murder, to which he pleaded not guilty. He was later charged with assault with intent to do great bodily harm, when during a preliminary trial hearing, he admitted that he and Dunn had a physical altercation on September 26, 1982, the day before she filmed the Hill Street's Blue episode in which she appeared. He denied assaulting Dunn, however, claiming she accidentally incurred the bruises when he tried to prevent her from leaving their home. Then, on September 21st, 1983, after 8 days of deliberation, the jury acquitted Sweeney of second-degree murder, but found him guilty of the lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter, and he was also convicted of misdemeanor assault for the altercation with Dunn that occurred on September 26, 1982. Dunn's family was rightly outraged and called it an injustice. After the trial, Sweeney was incarcerated at a medium security prison in Susanville, California, but however was released on parole in September of 1986 after having only served 3 years, 7 months, and 27 days of his 6.5 year sentence. And while what happened to Dominique Dunn was a tragedy, the biggest tragedy of this supposed curse was probably the one that befell Heather O'Rourke, who played Carol Ann Freeling in the first film as well as the following two sequels. Born in 1975, Heather really didn't have an acting career until at the age of 4 she was cast in the first Poltergeist in 1982. After this, she would appear in the TV shows Chips, Webster, The New Leave It to Beaver, Our House, and had a recurring role on Happy Days as Heather Feister. She would then go on to appear in Poltergeist 2, The Other Side in 1986 and Poltergeist 3 in 1988. These two sequels would get mixed reviews, unlike the first film, although O'Rourke's performances were praised, but unfortunately, Poltergeist 3 would be her final feature release before her death in 1988. In early 1987, O'Rourke became ill with, I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, but she was basically initially diagnosed with a parasitic disease, which she supposedly contracted from well water at her family's home in Big Bear Lake. She was later on diagnosed as having Crohn's disease, and she was prescribed cortisone injections to treat the disease during the time she was filming Poltergeist 3. The steroidal injections resulted in facial swelling of the cheeks, which gives her her kind of chipmunky appearance in Poltergeist 3. And O'Rourke's mother said that she was very self-conscious about this. On January 31st, 1988, O'Rourke began exhibiting flu-like symptoms. The following morning, she collapsed in her own home and was rushed to community hospital in El Cajon. En route, she went into cardiac arrest, but paramedics were able to restart her heart at 9:25 a.m. She was subsequently flown to the Children's Hospital of San Diego, where it was discovered that she had intestinal stenosis and that all her previous diagnoses had been misdiagnoses. Is that the word? Whatever. But she then went into emergency surgery. She survived the surgery, but however suffered another cardiac arrest while in the recovery room. Doctors performed CPR for over 30 minutes, but finally O'Rourke was sadly pronounced dead at 2:43 that afternoon. And O'Rourke's cause of death was ruled congenital stenosis of the intestine complicated by septic shock, and she was only 13 years old. O'Rourke died before they could finish filming the end for Poltergeist 3. And the director and everybody else involved with the film originally just didn't want to continue filming it after O'Rourke's death. They just felt it wasn't right. However, they did bring in a double for her. And that's why at the end of the movie, you only see Carol Ann from the back. You never see her from the front. Even though nobody involved with this movie wanted to do it at all, which is understandable. After Poltergeist 3 wrapped up, nobody involved with it or in the cast wanted to really talk about the supposed curse of, you know, Poltergeist and all the weird shit that happened while all three films had been made. Eventually, and they especially didn't want to talk about the death of Heather O'Rourke. Eventually, Zelda Rubinstein, who played Tangina in all three films, would go on TV and talk about it, but she was pretty evasive during the whole interview. But those two deaths weren't the only strange things that occurred during these movies. Oliver Robbins, who played Robbie Freeling in the first movie, claimed that when the clown doll attacks him during the thunderstorm, the arms really did wrap around his throat and it was actually strangling him, which freaked him out, which is understandable. And unfortunately, Dunn and O'Rourke weren't the only two actors who would die during the filming of these movies. Julian Beck, who played the evil preacher Kane in Poltergeist 2, was diagnosed with stomach cancer in 1983, which took his life soon after he finished work on the second installment of the series. So with the third film, which Kane also appears in, it's an entirely different actor playing Kane, but why he looks so similar to Beck is that no one's really sure if it was before or after he died, but they made a death mask of Beck and put it on the actor who plays Kane in the third film, so that's why he looks so similar to Beck in the second film. And then one more death would occur, and that was Will Sampson, who played Taylor, the Native American shaman, who died after undergoing a heart and lung transplant, which had a very slim survival rate. Now, the supposed cause for this curse, if that's what you want to call it, according to JoBeth Williams, who played the mom, Diane Freeling, in the first film, according to her, the reason all this weird shit happened was because Steven Spielberg had them use real Indian skeletons from India. And supposedly that this angered the spirits from the skeletons, and all this weird shit was... all this weird shit, and four deaths were caused. You know, and while that is creepy, it's not like Poltergeist was the first film to ever, or first horror film, to ever use real human skeletons. Back in the day, in the 1959 Vincent Price movie, House on Haunted Hill, near the end of the scene, near the end of the movie, there's a scene where a skeleton rises out of an acid bath and that was a real human skeleton. But nothing weird happened on that set or to the cast members, so, you know, it's kind of doubtful that that's why there's a quote-unquote curse on the Poltergeist films. And Williams' claims have never actually been verified, but it's pretty much become legend when it comes to this movie. Moving right along, next up we have 1983's Twilight Zone, the movie.
On June 24th, four acclaimed directors, George Miller, John Landis, Joe Dante, and Steven Spielberg, take you to another dimension.
Based off of Rod Serling's 1959 and 1964 TV show, The Twilight Zone, obviously, this is basically an anthology movie, or more science fiction slash horror anthology, that was produced by Steven Spielberg and John Landis, and also had Landis, Spielberg, Joe Dante, and George Miller directing the force, or each of them directing one of the four stories. It had a big cast that included Dan Aykroyd, Albert Brooks, Scatman Carruthers, John Lithgow, Vic Morrow, and Kathleen Quinlan. Burgess Meredith, Kevin McCarthy, and Bill Mummy would also make an appearance in the stories in this anthology. This movie is probably most famous for two of the segments, one of them being the fourth one, which was a John Lithgow starring Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, which, of course, as anybody who's read Richard Matheson's short story of the same name or seen the movie knows, involves a gremlin trying to tear off the wing of a plane. It is perhaps best known, however, unfortunately enough, for the John Landis-directed story, A Quality of Mercy, which is the first segment, and also is considered quote-unquote cursed due to the deaths of the segment's star, Vic Morrow, and two young child actors in a horrific, tragic accident. During Landis's filming of this segment, on July 23, 1982, at around 2:30 a.m., actor Vic Morrow and child actors Micah Din Lee, who was 7, and Renee Shin-Yi Chen, who was 6, died in an accident involving a helicopter being used on the set. The two child actors were hired in violation of California law, which prohibits child actors from working at night or in proximity to explosions and requires the presence of a teacher or social worker. This scene was not in Landis's original draft for the segment, but after Warner Brothers executive Lucy Fisher and Terry Semel objected that the central character of the segment was too unsympathetic, Landis came up with the idea of Morrow's character, Bill Connor, redeeming himself by rescuing two Vietnamese orphans. In the scene that served as the original ending, Bill was to have traveled back through time again and stumbled into a deserted Vietnamese village where he finds two young Vietnamese children left behind when a U.S. Army helicopter appears and begins shooting at them. Morrow was to take both children under his arms and escape out of the village as the hovering helicopter destroyed the village with multiple explosions. However, since this scene was filmed at 2:30 in the morning, when it's obviously quite dark out, the helicopter pilot had trouble navigating through the fireballs created by the pyrotechnic effects for the sequence. A technician on the ground did not know this and detonated two of the pyrotechnic charges close together. The flash force of the two explosions caused the low-flying helicopter to spin out of control and crash land on top of Morrow and the two children as they were crossing a small pond away from the village mock-up. All three were killed instantly. Morrow and Lee were decapitated by the helicopter's top rotor blades, while Chen was crushed to death by one of the struts. And the cause of the accident was stated as follows. The probable cause of the accident was a detonation of debris-laden high-temperature special effects explosions too near a low-flying helicopter, leading to foreign object damage to one rotor blade and delamination due to heat to the other rotor blade, the separation of the helicopter's tail rotor assembly, and the uncontrolled descent of the helicopter. The proximity of the helicopter, which was around 25 feet off the ground, to the special effects explosion was due to the failure to establish direct communications and coordination between the pilot, who was in command of the helicopter operation, and the film director, who was in charge of the filming operation. It was later discovered that Micah and Renee were being paid under the table to circumvent California's child labor laws, which means California did not allow children to work at night. And Landis decided to not make the two kids' parents sign a waiver. Associate producer George Falsey Jr. told the children's parents not to tell any of the firefighters on set that the children were part of the scene, and also hid them from a fire safety officer who also worked as a welfare worker. This tragedy led to civil and criminal action suits filed against the filmmakers, which lasted for nearly a decade. Landis, Falsey, production manager Dan Allingham, pilot Dorsey Wingo, and explosive specialist Paul Stewart were all tried and eventually acquitted on charges of manslaughter in a 9-month trial in 1986 to 1987, which of course caused an outrage, which is understandable and not at all in the wrong. Producer and co-director Steven Spielberg was so disgusted by Landis's handling of the situation, he ended their friendship and publicly called for the end of the New Hollywood era, where directors had almost complete control over the film. When approached by the press about the accident, he stated, "No movie is worth dying for. I think people are standing up much more now than ever before to producers and directors who ask too much. If something isn't safe, it's the right and responsibility of every actor or crew member to yell cut." And co-director George Miller was also so repulsed by the entire scenario, he abandoned post-production of the segment, leaving Joe Dante to supervise the editing. It's quite obvious that Landis is completely at fault for everything that happened. You know, he broke the law. He let them shoot in unsafe situations, I guess is the best way to put it. And he completely endangered everybody's lives doing this. Landis pretty much refuses to talk about this incident and just kind of really blows everything off as if it was no big deal. You know, in my opinion, he definitely should have been charged and found guilty. There's no excuse for what happened, and it's just another example of money talks, and money can get you out of anything. Next up, we have 1994's The Crow.
People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, just sometimes, a crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
Gasoline, I smell.
Victims, aren't we all?
Let me, let me
based on James O'Barr's comic book series or graphic novel of the same movie, or of the same name. The movie opens on October 30th, which is Devil's Night in Detroit. Sergeant Albrecht is at the scene of a crime where Shelley Webster has been beaten and raped. Her fiancé, musician Eric Draven, lies dead on the street after having been stabbed, shot, and thrown out of the window. The couple had planned on getting married the following day, Halloween. And as he leaves for the hospital with Shelley, Albrecht meets a young girl, Sarah, who says that she is their friend and that they take care of her. Albrecht reluctantly tells her that Shelley is dying. The movie then goes a year later, where a crow lands on Eric Draven's tombstone, and Draven comes back from the dead and basically seeks revenge on those who murdered him and his fiancée, Shelley. While this is a very excellent movie and is one that you should definitely see if you have never, for some reason, ever seen it, but avoid the sequels. They're pretty much shit, except for The Crow, City of Angels, is at least halfway decent, but avoid all the other sequels. But anyway, unfortunately, this is most well known for the death of its star, Brandon Lee, son of Bruce Lee. On March 31st, 1993, Lee was filming a scene where his character Eric is shot after witnessing the beating and rape of his fiance, actor Michael Massey, who played the character Fumboy, was supposed to fire a .44 Magnum Smith & Wesson Model 629 revolver at Lee as he walks into the room. A previous scene using the same gun had called for dummy cartridges filled with bullets, but no powder or primer to be loaded into the revolver. For close-up scenes that use a revolver where the bullets are clearly visible from the front and do not require the gun to actually be fired, dummy cartridges provide a more realistic appearance than blank rounds, which have no bullet. Instead of purchasing commercial dummy cartridges, however, the film's prop crew, hampered by time constraints, created their own by putting the bullets from live rounds, dumping the powder charges, then reinserting the bullets. In this scene, which called for the revolver to be actually fired at Lee from a distance of 12 to 15 feet, the dummy cartridges were exchanged for blank rounds, which feature a live powder charge and primer but no bullet, thus allowing the gun to be fired without the risk of an actual projectile. As the production company had sent the firearms specialist home early, responsibility for the guns was given to a prop assistant who was unaware of the role for inspecting all firearms before and after any handling. Therefore, the barrel was not checked for obstructions when the time came to load it with the blank rounds. Since a bullet from the dummy round was already trapped in the barrel, this caused the .44 Magnum bullet to be fired out of the barrel with virtually the same force as if the gun had been loaded with a live round, and it struck Lee in the abdomen, mortally wounding him. After Massey had fired the gun, nobody was aware that anything was wrong at first, but then when they realized that Lee wasn't getting back up, they realized that something had gone horribly wrong. And unfortunately, Lee passed away. This, of course, led to a bunch of rumors, especially since his father, martial arts expert Bruce Lee, had died under suspicious circumstances. A lot of people said that Bruce Lee was murdered by the Chinese mafia, and so, of course, people assumed that the same had happened to Brandon Lee as well. You know, the reality of it is that it was a horrible accident that took the life of a young, promising actor. Michael Massey, who played Fun Boy, dealt with this really hard as he basically blamed himself for Lee's death. And he carried it with him until his own death in 2016 due to stomach cancer. And that, dear listener, leads us into 1976's The Omen.
For generations, the Thornes have been a family of tremendous wealth, position, and power. The perfect marriage of Ambassador Robert Thorne and his wife Catherine was fulfilled by the birth of their son, Damien. And then, when the child was 5 years old, something terrible happened. And then, it happened again. Was it an accident? Was it murder? Was it a coincidence? Or was it an omen?
Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
20th Century Fox presents a film of psychological suspense about an occurrence of earth-shaking importance. Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, The Omen.
I was at the hospital, Mr. Thorne, the night your son was born. I saw its mother. You saw its mother.
I have fears. I've seen fears.
What kind of fears?
Its mother, Mr. Thorne.
You saw my wife.
Its mother.
What is it you're trying to say?
His mother was alive.
This is not a human child. Make no mistake.
There are those who will die for him. There are those who will kill for him. Who is he? What does he want? Where did he come from? And can he be stopped? Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, The Omen. If this is the truth, where does it end?
The movie centers around American diplomat Robert Thorne and his wife Catherine and the arrival of their newborn child, Damien. Damien eventually is revealed to be the son of Satan, the Antichrist, and the film revolves around a bunch of people trying to destroy and or stop him, or the cult that's trying to preserve him, I guess is the best way to put it, so that he can bring about the end of the world. This was followed by 4 sequels, I believe, and a remake. The remake is shit. The sequels vary in quality and story and shit like that. But for my money, the first film is the best. But like every other movie in this episode, this movie, or The Omen, was said to have been cursed from the very beginning. The Omen was the brainchild of born-again Christian executive Robert Munger, who pitched the idea for The Omen to be the next blockbuster horror opportunity following the success of The Exorcist in 1973. Shortly after, however, Munger was quick to warn everyone involved that although he hadn't had a change of heart, he knew that a movie set involving the son of the devil was sure to be cursed, welcoming evil agents into the production. And almost from the very beginning, misfortune struck swift, falling first upon The Omen's protagonist, played by Academy Award winner Gregory Peck. Peck supposedly canceled a flight he planned for reasons unknown. Some reports claim that the crew hired the plane to use for the cast, but ended up not needing the aircraft. Either way, Peck was thankful he never got on it. The plane crashed the same day, killing all passengers on board. What was even more evil about it, I guess, is that when the plane hit the ground, it landed on the vehicle with members of the pilot's family inside, killing not only all the passengers and the pilot, but the pilot's family as well. However, the plane incidents didn't stop after that. While Peck was heading to England to shoot scenes for The Omen, this time actually making his flight, the plane was struck by lightning, but this time around, nobody got hurt. And David Seltzer's, the film's writer, took a separate flight to England to join the cast and crew 2 days after Peck's flight landed. Seltzer's plane was also struck by lightning in an incident that strikes, or in a similar incident, but thankfully nobody was hurt in this situation either. Mark Newfield, the Omen's executive producer, had an encounter he dubbed more than coincidental when he, Peck, and others planned to dine out at a restaurant one evening. Before the group was to appear at the restaurant, however, the building was reportedly destroyed in a violent explosion. So that makes Peck a 3-time avoider of death during the production of this movie. However, Newfield might have been a victim of this curse again when he and his wife checked out early from their London hotel. A short time after, that hotel was leveled by another explosion. Reports at that time insisted that the IRA had been responsible for several explosions around London at the time, even if others attributed the violence to a curse set forth by the devil himself. And the special effects designer for designing probably one of the grossest scenes in The Omen, where a victim gets decapitated, fell victim to a chillingly similar accident. After moving on from the film to begin his next project, he and his wife were driving and involved in an accident that ended up decapitating his wife. After the accident, he drew comparison to that scene and even claimed that there was a road sign to the side of the crash pointing travelers to a town called Omen, 66.6 kilometers away. Lee Remick, in another one of the movie scenes, is driving through a park with Damien when a bunch of baboons attack Remick's car. Reportedly, what happened in this scene wasn't supposed to happen and wasn't planned, and Remick's terror of the events that are going on is actually real. There is also another report that's never really been verified, that the animal trainer hired to assist in that scene was killed the very next day when the trainer was grabbed by the head and killed instantly by a tiger. Again, this was never really verified as being true, but it's become quite the popular rumor. And then in the iconic cemetery scene, Gregory Peck's stuntman was attacked by trained Rottweilers. The dogs ignored commands from their trainer and, for reasons unknown, were able to cause some heavy injuries. Like I said, this would eventually lead to the rumors that the film might have actually been cursed by the devil himself. But, I mean, these are all coincidental. I mean, I can see why people would think that, but, I mean, come on. And that leads us into what has been called one of the most cursed and haunted sets and films in all of movie history. And that is 1968's Rosemary's Baby.
You know how I actors are. They're all a bit self-centered. I dreamed someone was raping. We have to make a baby. Dr. Hill?
Congratulations.
You're pregnant.
Now to a fine, healthy baby. Here, here.
Here. I have a pain. Here.
Pregnant women gain weight. They don't lose it.
Pain like that is a warning that something isn't right.
The film centers around Rosemary, who believes that she cannot become pregnant. It is eventually discovered, however, that she does get pregnant and that her child may, in fact, be the son of Satan. I forgot to mention that this is based on an Ira Levin novel of the same name. The story of Rosemary's Baby is, of course, mired in tragedy. The first unlucky soul to be affected by this was the actor Kameda. Details of his death are still scarce, but director Roman Polanski told it this way. In autumn of 1968, the then 37-year-old Kameda was roughhousing at a party when he fell off a rocky embankment and into a four-month coma. Komoda never regained consciousness and died in Poland the following year. In April of 1969, infamous producer William Castle, sick with worry from the hate mail he received constantly, was suddenly stricken with severe kidney stones. While delirious in the hospital, he hallucinated scenes from the film and was said to have yelled out, "Rosemary, for God's sake, drop the knife." Castle recovered, just barely, but never made another Hollywood hit again. And of course, there's the gruesome events that happened to Polanski himself, which have been told and retold into legend even by him. Polanski had relocated to California alongside his new girlfriend, actress Sharon Tate, who was fresh off her first movie role as a witch in Eye of the Devil, just before filming began. She had gunned hard for the lead role in Rosemary's Baby, but Paramount wanted Mia Farrow instead. Tate would loiter around the set, appearing uncredited like a ghost in the background of Rosemary's young people-only party scene, and some became increasingly obsessed with the occult. Many years later, a friend quoted her in print as having said, "The devil is beautiful. Most people think he's ugly, but he's not." Polanski last saw Tate, by then his wife and very pregnant, in July of 1969, noting in his autobiography a grotesque thought he had at times. "You will never see her again," he wrote. Unfortunately, he was right. As Tate was brutally murdered on August 8th by the Manson family, as was her unborn son, all while Rosemary's Baby was in theaters. Author Ira Levin, who I said this movie was based on his book, even he was unable to escape this quote-unquote curse. He suffered his first marriage crumbling, with the divorce finalized in 1968, and he would never once again ride the fame that Rosemary's baby brought him. And the Catholic Church also slapped a C rating, which means condemned, onto the film for its mockery of religious persons and practices. And that leads us into the final film of this episode, which is probably the most well-known and most heard about, and that is 1973's The Exorcist.
Somewhere between science and superstition, there is another world. The world of darkness. Nobody expected it. Nobody believed it. And nothing could stop it.
There are no experts. You probably know as much about possession as most priests. Look, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She says she's the devil himself.
I'm telling you that that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. Now, I want you to tell me that you know for a fact that there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her mind. You tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good. You tell me that!
One hope, the only hope, the Exorcist.
Based on William Peter Blatty's novel of the same name, I'm not even gonna, you know, break down the movie. If you're a listener of this podcast, I'm sure you've seen this. Everybody and their fucking grandmother has. And if you've never seen it, then why the fuck are you listening to this podcast? Go and listen to, or go and see it right now. Watch it, whatever. See it, watch it right now. It's definitely not the world's scariest movie as it's been touted as. And it's definitely slow and boring at parts, but I mean it's looked at as a classic and rightfully so. It's just not one of my favorite movies. Even though this caused quite a stir and saw terrified cinema goers vomiting and fainting. One woman even broke her jaw after she passed out. But once again, the set of this movie was full of deaths and weird accidents and shit like that. The deaths of at least 4 people have been linked to the film, supposedly, and some believe that this is proof of the Exorcist curse. Or Exorcist curse. God damn it, I can't talk again today. Anyway, these deaths include Jack McGowan, who played the eccentric film director Burke Dennings, and in the film was killed by the demon-plagued Dragon McNeil. Ahead of the film's release, Jack died from complications related to the flu, which he caught during the London flu epidemic of 1973. Vasiliki Malarios, who played Father Damien Karras' mother, also passed away that same year before The Exorcist hit the big screen. The star, who had no previous acting experience and was cast after being spotted at a restaurant, was ruled to have died from natural causes at an autopsy had been performed. Also during the production, a number of the cast and crew, including Linda Blair, who played Regan, and Max von Sydow, who played Father Marin, had family members die. The first was Max von Sydow's brother. Jason Miller, who played Father Karras, also had a near-fatal motorcycle accident while during filming. The movie was also faced with multiple production delays, but the most notable one happened early on into the production. The set for Reagan's family home burned down in 1972 after a bird flew into the circuit box. And eerily, the only part of the set that survived was the bedroom where the exorcisms would take place. And after this incident, a real priest, Thomas M. Keene, was called in to bless the set. There was also back injuries involved in the production of this. Ellen Bernstein, who played the concerned mom Chris McNeil, suffered a spinal injury while being hoisted around on a harness. She was left on crutches for the rest of the production. And she reportedly told William Friedkin, the film's director, that a crew member was pulling me too hard, but she claimed he dismissed her concerns. She also reported that the movements fractured her lower spine, and that where it happened is actual footage used in the movie. And after the movie was released to theaters, during one screening in Rome, it was reported that a bolt of lightning struck a church opposite the cinema. In America, as I said earlier, one woman passed out and broke her jaw, and later sued Warner Brothers for an undisclosed sum. Meanwhile, in the UK, it was reported that St. John's ambulance staff attended screenings to help distressed cinema goers. However, even though claims about the exorcist curse continue to this day, it is mostly assumed that all this was just a marketing tool for the film. So what is my take on all of this? The loss of life is always a tragedy. More often than not, even making a splash and going unnoticed in everyday life, except for those it affects. But when it happens on the set of a movie or involves the crew of a movie, it's a big deal. Sometimes bad things just happen, without rhyme or reason. Sometimes they can't be prevented. Do I think these movies were cursed? No. But I do think that sometimes when something tragic happens, like the things I've talked about on this episode, people look for something outside of human blame to make sense of it. Like back in the olden days of Europe, when villagers would blame werewolves, vampires, etc. for brutal deaths for what were more than likely serial or mass murders, because while it may be commonplace these days, back then they couldn't wrap their minds around something so horrible being committed by regular human beings. Sometimes things just happen, and it will always weigh on the minds of those that witnessed these events and were involved. And that, I believe, is a true curse of these films. Before I wrap this all up, I just wanted to make a correction I forgot to make earlier. Last episode, when I was talking about Otis, I had mistakenly claimed that Howard Stern was in it. But what I really meant to say was Daniel Stern. I don't know how the fuck I got the two mixed up, but I did. And I apologize, and this is my retraction from Howard Stern being in it to Daniel Stern. And that wraps it up, guys. As always, you can reach me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.